Welcome to Prosecco and Prose, episode 28.
This week's Prosecco is Enza.
This week's prose is The Spiderling by Marcia Preston. Thank you for joining us for an episode of Prosecco and Prose. I'm Amy.
And I'm Wendy. We're a deep dive virtual book club.
That's kind of like a quiz-free lit class you never knew you needed.
So let's
pop a cork for this week's episode of Prosecco and Prose.
For those who are listening in the car, please don't drink and drive.
Save the bubbly for later.
Our labels are on point for our prose this season, don't you think?
Oh, I agree.
I mean, take this one for example. This one has red, white, and black from our book cover, which we both loved.
Oh, and then the photo. I mean, this little girl, she's hugging her mother. I mean, it's just so emotional. I truly got all the feels before I even opened the book. You?
Oh, totally agree. But these swirly designs on the label also kind of make me think of a spiderweb.
Okay. Did you have Prosecco before you came over?
No.
Spidey senses? You know those things are real. I've done my spider research.
I know that, Amy.
Are you sure?
Yes. I'm not saying it, you know, looks like a spiderweb, but it's just that it you know, kind of reminds me of one at first glance.
Well, you know, art, like literature, is a personal interpretation. So while I don't necessarily see a spider web, it doesn't mean that others won't.
Exactly.
I mean, I'll just leave it at that. But you're right, the colors are perfect. Now, let's look onto the backside of the label. So it says Enza is a DOC. Shows me that it's extra dry, 11% alcohol.
And this one was under $20, wasn't it?
Yes, it was $15. And the average cost on Vivino says $16. So we got a deal.
Well, you know what they say. A penny saved is a
penny for the next bottle of bubbly.
Not exactly the saying, but I'm going to have to say that works pretty well.
I mean, it's a P&P quotable, right?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
It is now.
It is now. So the label says, let's see here. Vibrant, refreshing Italian sparkling wine with flavors of peach, green apples, honeysuckle, and a touch of citrus in each sip. Enza is made from premium grapes grown in the heart of Italy's Prosecco region. Go ahead. Life is yours for the tasting.
I like that. Life is yours for the tasting. I like it.
It sounds really fun, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, my green apples are back.
Well, let's see if we can taste it, though, so don't get too excited.
I'll get us poured while you tell us what you gathered from their website. Here, hand me your glass.
Okay. Well, it really wasn't a whole lot, but Enza is named for the quintessentially Italian woman that exudes sophistication and elegance, inspiring us to produce Prosecco reflective of these qualities.
Oh, sophistication and elegance? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's your language, my posh friend, not mine. I may not be Enza's target audience.
Oh, I think you are exactly their target audience. You might just need to drink more before you exude sophistication and elegance.
Girl, if I drink too much, I can assure that sophistication and elegance will not be what I exude.
Why did I go there? I never learn.
Nope.
So to wrap up, Enza lightens the moment with a sophisticated sparkle to make your everyday extraordinary.
Oh, I can make your everyday extraordinary, my friend. Let's see if one of us has at least a bit of sophistication and elegance. Hoping you can bring that.
We'll see. It's very yellow in the glass. It's almost a bright yellow.
It's yellow all right. I was noticing that when I was pouring. Kind of like a morning after booze bender yellow.
Amy.
Just kidding.
Oh, my gosh.
You really didn't expect me to bring on the sophistication and elegance, did you?
I had hopes.
I mean, we've been kind of doing this for a minute. Just keeping it real, like real classy and my glassy.
Real predictable. Anyway, it's yellow.
It's yellow.
It's yellow. It's also not very bubbly. You see that?
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I mean, I only have one little stream of bubbles.
Yeah, there were actually a lot of bubbles on the pour. You know, a pretty nice mousse, but now I have no Prologi in my glass. Do you? Let me see.
No.
No. And there could actually be a reason for that.
Really? Did you get us a Calmo Prosecco?
Tranquillo.
Tranquillo.
But no. Let me bring my Professor Prosecco knowledge to our fellow listeners. That I can do. With sophistication and elegance.
Bring it.
Well, I learned from my book that we got in Arizona. Remember the book? The Wine Club by Maureen Christian Petroski.
Mm-hmm.
I read that you should always hand wash your bubbly glasses.
I'm not hand washing all the time.
I know. It's such a difficult process, right, Wendy?
Well, it just takes time.
Please.
But continue.
The science of drinking bubbly says if any residue like soap is left on your glass, you won't get the perlage, you know, the bubbles.
Hmm. That's interesting. Did not know that.
Well, I thought so.
I mean, that book has a lot of fun gems in it.
It did. It would make for a really good reels or, you know, what are those longer ones that we do? The
IGTV.
Oh, the IGTV experiment. Mm-hmm. You know, you love science.
Oh, I do. And, you know, we're always looking for something fun to share with our friends.
Always. So if you aren't, you know, running your dishwasher very hot, it could leave soap residue and thus, my friend, affect the perlage.
I suppose it could also affect the smell and taste then.
Oh, I'm sure it very well could. And speaking of smell, you know, I mean, just really, I'm getting the honeysuckle. It's really strong. I didn't really even have to sniff at it too much. It's really floral. You know, I actually had a honeysuckle tree on my rooftop patio, but sadly, it didn't survive.
You must have let me get near it. I seem to have that effect on plants, whereas you got at least two green thumbs. You could have two green big toes, too.
I think my green thumbs went AWOL with that poor honeysuckle tree. Mm. I mean, I was trying to transplant it, you know, into a larger planter and broke it at the base of the stem. Josh, he was not overly happy with me.
Does he like honeysuckle?
Well, it was an expensive tree.
Oh, oops.
But you know what's new? He's always mad at me about something. Anyway, what are you getting on the nose?
Well, it's very honey for me. And there is some floral, but I'm getting just a hint. Are you getting something stronger? I mean, it's really a nice smell, though.
Oh, I agree. It really does have a nice smell. But let's see how that translates to taste.
Huh. Well, the lack of bubbles translated. I mean, there's almost no bubbles in the mouth either.
Oh.
Right?
Right.
And I can really taste the apple on this one, though.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But my apple is back. It tastes like a very ripe apple, though. But it does kind of have a citrusy finish on the front, wouldn't you say? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not too bad at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's got this, call it like a honey citrus apple taste. What do you think?
Hmm.
It's not a bad start at all.
Yeah, I'm getting your honey, too.
Yeah. I'll be curious to see what happens with the honey. I mean, at least me, tend to find those on the sweeter side, and they're not always to our liking.
That's true. We'll see where this one goes. I mean, we haven't had real great luck this season, but
I know.
We've had some great literature. But let's move on to our author and introduce her.
Now, I know you were pretty excited about this one, and she was so generous in answering our questions. Of course, you went off the deep end.
Always do.
But before we get to those, let's get some basic info on Marcia Preston.
Okay, fill us in.
So Ms. Preston grew up and still lives in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
She is a fellow teacher and taught high school English for over a decade. She edited and published Byline for 20 years, and that was a trade magazine for aspiring authors.
I'd never heard of it before we read that.
I hadn't either. She is the author of 8 novels and won the Mary Higgins Clark Award for Suspense Fiction for one of her earlier works, Song of Bones.
I haven't read that one yet.
I haven't either. And as a huge lover of suspense novels, I will definitely be checking that out.
I'll have to take a look at that one, too. And I know I sound like a broken record, but you have to read Trudy's Promise.
I know, I'm going to.
That's one of my favorite by her. I mean, it's historical fiction, novels set in Germany, the Berlin Wall type of stuff.
Okay.
You know, little love, little family separation. Definitely lots of suspense.
My kind of book.
I mean, she has this ability to write in so many genres, too. I mean, she's really just a gifted writer.
Oh, I will definitely be reading more of her books. You know, well, actually you don't, but I'm going to tell you now.
I know.
I found this author page, and it listed other authors similar to Miss Preston. And guess who was on the list?
Who?
We've discussed this author's works.
Huh. If it's somebody she likes, she said in her email that she was an Ann Patchett fan. Was it her?
Ooh, great guess, but no.
Hmm, okay. Well, I mean, I say Ann Patchett because when I was reading The Dutch House, her writing reminds me so much of Marcia's. I think I did even tell you that back then. I mean, the family bonds sort of gave me the same feels as Trudy's Promise.
And that is when you first recommended I read Trudy's Promise. Mm-hmm. Do you want to guess again?
Playing Stump the Chump today. I thought we kind of gave up on some of the games.
Yeah, but I feel like this is something that's in like really good for you. So I,
okay.
Like you get this kind of stuff right. Before I do. So I want to hear your guess.
Let me see. Let me think about this. Now, the only other author that
No pressure, though.
There's no pressure, but I've got someone on my mind here.
Okay.
I mean, really, the only other author that I can think of, and you said we discussed.
Yeah, we discussed this author's work.
With that kind of a writing voice would be, I'm going for a long shot here, but okay. It was one of my favorite short stories, Mary Gordon?
Yes.
Shut up.
You got it. I'm not surprised, but I'm very impressed. You've got skills. Cheers.
Thank you. I say that because, you know, Mary Gordon's writing is so wholesome. It's tidy. It's neat and concise. And so is Marsha Preston's.
Yeah.
I mean, you just get such a good feeling when you read their stories. Clean, again, concise. And I mean, their writing style is just very, very tight. I mean, there's nothing more I can say. It's just tight. You're plunged into the story immediately. The characters are also really believable. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I connected with both authors right away in their stories.
Yeah, I get it. And I completely agree. Now, there was one more author on the list that I love and makes me want to read Marsha's books even more. Sarah Pekkanen.
Oh, I've heard you mention her before. Isn't she part of a writing duo?
Yes.
I've never read her work, though, before.
Yeah, so she is part of that duo. Like I said, it's the other girl's name is Hendrix, but she also writes alone. But enough on these similar authors.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our author today.
Yeah, let's move back to Marsha Preston.
Right, Ms. Marsha Preston. Awesome on her own.
She is.
Yes. Now, we were curious about how she found time to write when she was teaching, parenting. I mean, as teachers ourselves, and I mean, you, Amy, as a parent, knowing how much time that takes. We wondered if she had a particular writing process that helped make sure she got pen to paper, because I need some tips.
Right. I mean, teaching and parenting can really take a lot of your time, especially teaching English.
Oh, yeah.
For all those papers. Yes. And, try grading 150 papers.
No, thanks.
Mm. But she says it comes back just to carving out the time to do it. I mean, deliberately just setting time aside, which she did by getting up at, I think she said 5 a.m.
Ew.
Yeah. And writing for about an hour before her kids got up.
Well, props to her, because I would not have the dedication to do that. Not in the morning. Nope.
You know, I get my best work done in the morning.
I mean, know.
I probably do more before 9 a.m. than most people.
I know.
What did you do when you were teaching, though? I mean, I thought you got up for a 6 a.m. yoga class.
Well, I did, but that's yoga. Like, I can use my practice to fully wake up. Like, you know, I'm kind of half asleep. I don't wake up and then immediately start using my brain for writing. I know my limitations.
You know, yoga makes me fall asleep. I went with my friend Deanna one time, fell asleep.
Well, I have fallen asleep, but...
Ugh. But I guess it's good to know oneself. I guess.
Yes, it is. Now we, and by that I mean you, asked a lot of questions pertaining to the book, and I think they will make more sense if we... I mean, I'm just think we should introduce our characters and give a summary before we get to those. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I did ask a lot of questions, and I think they would probably make sense as we discuss.
Yeah. When people have a little bit more backstory on the story.
I mean, I kind of went down a rabbit hole with her, you know, since she was so receptive to just
shocking
for us, you know, to discuss her book.
You and I can always find a rabbit hole.
Or make one.
Now, that is also true. So there are quite a few interesting characters in the novel. Talking about you, Birdie.
Ooh, I am such a birdie. Loved that character.
Yeah, you will be a birdie for sure.
Oh, I will.
But as I was saying, we're just going to introduce our two main characters. I think that'll suffice for here,
yeah.
Don't you think?
I mean, because we could go on and on with this book
right,
for hours.
There's so many characters. We're going to talk about the mother-daughter duo the story is about, just for now. So Kiwi is 11. She lost her soldier father, Deacon, in Iraq when she was 8. She is a very bright child who loves to read and learn new words.
Well, and then we have her mother, Libby. I mean, Libby, who did not have a very good home life as a child and struggles to break the pattern with her own daughter.
Well, and Kiwi's father's death did not help at all.
Oh, no, it didn't. Quick tangent.
Okay.
Since we have some interesting names.
Oh, yes.
You know, I'm so fascinated with the name game.
You are.
My voodoo name book and all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to ask Miss Marcia how she came up with the names.
Of course you did. I did like the novel's backstory on Kiwi's name, but what did Miss Preston tell you?
Well, she said naming characters is one of the most fun parts for her. It would be for me, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just thinks about each character, you know, who they are, what they want, the personality, and said a name just comes to her head, right? Mm. Easy breezy. After she names the characters, she can't think of them as anyone else.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I feel like I would have a name that I like, and then I would shape a character to it. Her way seems much more organic, authentic.
There are probably, you know, authors who name characters your way. I mean, everybody's got their own process. I would use my voodoo name book.
Of course you would.
Mm-hmm, I would.
Before we get into the summary, The Spiderling, published in November 2020, is a mystery, and there will be spoilers in this summary.
All right.
So...
But not all the spoilers. We're going to leave some of them out.
No. If you don't want that, it's a pretty quick read, just under 300 pages, and truly so good.
I got to ask you this. Did it, like, take you 4 hours to read?
Not quite. It did take me longer than that, but I couldn't put it down, and I read until 4:30 in the morning.
Oh, I told you it was so good.
You did. Now, the story is told from two perspectives.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. Libby's in limited third person, mm-hmm. and Kiwi's in first person from her journal entries.
I loved Kiwi's voice.
Same.
I asked Miss Marcia how she created Kiwi's voice. You know, she's just such a little precocious 11-year-old girl. And Marcia told me that it came from her two granddaughters.
Hmm.
One who is a word person, word nerds like us, right?
Yes.
And very smart. And then the other who has the nerve to run off into the desert by herself.
That would be you.
Mm-hmm. And fun fact, they're also military children.
The grandchildren are, right?
Yes, yeah, the grandchildren. Yep. And one of them told her that she kind of felt temporary everywhere she moved.
Mm.
And Marcia actually put those words in Kiwi's mouth.
Yeah, I remember that line. I mean, I've really enjoyed moving as an adult, but I think it's certainly got to be different for kids.
I'm ready to move now.
I know. I'm getting close, you know. It's coming up to that point. But, you know, my littles in the classroom, they're always so welcoming and sweet to new students. But I think it's harder as you get older.
Yeah, especially when you start to become a part of teams and clubs and, you know, things of that nature. I also love that she dedicated the book to military brats,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I raised one who married one, and now they are raising one of their own.
That's true.
It definitely has its challenges and rewards.
For sure.
One more note on Kiwi from our author. I asked Marcia if there was something, you know, she learned when writing this novel and, you know, took her by surprise. She said it was how easy Kiwi's voice came to her.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
She never felt like she had to force anything, that she really was, you know, maybe Kiwi.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt that, you know, maybe she's still a little girl at heart. I loved that.
I know. I just love that
melted.
So much. I know. I mean, I hope I'm still a little girl at heart as well.
Oh, me too. You and me, princess, we will never grow up.
Clearly. But maybe in a different way. But anyways, I hope so. But that does seem to be happening, which is good, since we're using Prosecco to preserve ourselves.
Oh, definitely.
Now, the story opens with Libby throwing a gun into the ocean.
Oh.
Libby and Kiwi are on the run, and the reader learns pretty quickly that this mother-daughter relationship is very strained. I mean, you just felt that immediately, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Kiwi is all Libby has of her soldier husband. Libby has no idea how to be her mother. And Kiwi is a murderer.
And that's just the first chapter, right?
Mm-hmm. I was immediately pulled in. I mean, how could you not, right?
Right.
Now, Libby, trying to get as far from San Jose as fast as possible, she and Kiwi end up in Sand Flats, a small town in the desert, where Libby meets Myra, a former soldier herself, who offers them a place to stay. From Kiwi's journal, we learn of her father's death from a roadside bomb in Iraq,
ugh,
how she believes her mother can no longer love her, and how she believes she's going to hell for what she did, which is what really bothers her. Because her dad is in heaven, and she won't get to see him.
Oh, just such a poor girl. I know.
And the things, her thought process was just incredible, didn't you think?
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, then it was her journal entries. I mean, thinking she is going to hell. Right. We find that in her journal entries. Yep. I mean, this really made my heart hurt.
I know.
Libby gets a job waitressing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And between their two viewpoints, we see the struggle of Libby and Kiwi trying to connect, but with each unwilling to let down their guard and risk getting hurt, right? Right. They just seem to kind of drift further and further apart.
Yeah, the gap is definitely widening.
Mm-hmm. Libby, who has a history of making poor choices in men, I thought that was evident.
Yep.
Minus Kiwi's dad, of course. She begins to get, you know, friendly with Sean, mm-hmm. the owner of the bar Libby works at. Much to Kiwi's dismay, I thought.
I mean, yes. Yeah, Kiwi wasn't thrilled about that. But, I mean, think about it from Kiwi's viewpoint. She's watched her mom suffer, and even she herself has suffered from these less than, shall we say, stellar men.
I mean, things that a child should never have to deal with, right?
Exactly. Kiwi decides this is the only way she can fix things with her and her mom. And it will also, you know, this is really important to her, also help her chances of getting out of hell early.
Mm-hmm.
She has to return to San Jose and admit what she did.
Right.
If she does that, then her mother won't have to keep running and lying to protect her.
And maybe even mom can get a better job. You know, the one that Myra is offering.
Right. But wait, that requires a background check.
Right.
Not going to happen. I mean, she knows the law is probably looking for her.
Exactly. She's kind of sort of stuck, right?
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward. While attending a science fair, Kiwi runs away, or rather heads to San Jose.
Right.
I'd still call it running away.
Right? I would, but Kiwi did not call it that. She's solving a problem.
Right. After some very close calls, the lovely Birdie, my favorite character, makes an appearance on this
trip.
That
was a delightful moment in the book, right?
I just felt so me. And then after that, a soldier escorts her on the bus ride. Mm-hmm. And then he also makes a connection for Kiwi to her dad.
Yeah, I loved that.
I mean, the stars aligned, did they not?
It did.
So Kiwi finally makes it to the San Jose Police Department, right?
Mm-hmm.
While confessing to the murder. And it doesn't go quite as Kiwi hoped.
Not quite.
She does meet Jeremiah.
Ooh, Jeremiah Redbone Summernigh. Was that not the best name?
And wasn't that sexy? Summernigh.
The whole thing.
But he was a soldier who served with her dad in Iraq.
Right.
And she finally learns more about her dad as Libby couldn't ever talk about him, right?
No.
It was hard.
Yeah, it was hard. So the soldier on the bus that, you know, was her escort.
Right.
He helped her find Jeremiah Redbone Summernigh.
Summernigh. Thank God.
Kiwi also learns her mother kept letters from her paternal grandmother secret from her, a woman Kiwi has fond memories of, but hasn't seen since her father's funeral, which further strains the mother-daughter relationship.
Well, she learns that Grandma offered them a place to stay when they had to leave the base after her dad's death.
Right.
And then their living arrangements since haven't, you know, been less than desirable.
They have not been very nice, mm-hmm. that's for sure. Now, we won't tell you how it all goes down at the police station and who really pulled the trigger, but eventually Libby and Kiwi end up back in Sand Flats, and Kiwi's hope that her mother will finally love her is fading as she sees her mother and Sean growing ever closer.
Mm.
Kiwi, feeling the odd one out, decides to take her grandmother up on her offer to stay with her in Alabama. Libby reluctantly lets her go, but this might be the thing that finally helps bring them together. There's a lot packed into this novel.
Wasn't it just hard to come up with a summary and just try to not tell everybody everything about it?
Oh, I know, because...
Which we wanted to tell them enough to intrigue them to read it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just so good.
Just read it, just read it, just read it.
I mean, it just gave me all the feels.
Yes.
I mean, I absolutely love this novel. And the ending was so good.
Oh, so good.
I mean, I felt relieved after all this grief I felt throughout the entire novel.
Same, same, same. I mean... It was perfection. It really was perfection. Now, as the wives of soldiers who have spent time in both Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
we definitely had a connection with this story, and we're curious as to how Ms. Preston got the idea for her book.
Well, she said the story arose mostly from a worry.
Of course.
You know, a worried mother who had a deployed son, and I know that feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't, but I mean, you do, and that makes sense, perfect sense. There's just so much worry for military families when a loved one is deployed.
Oh, I know. She thought of her two granddaughters, the two granddaughters we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And what would happen if their dad didn't come back from Iraq?
Oh.
And those girls, they had a stable mom, But then again, what if they didn't?
Yeah.
I mean, you never know. I mean, what if grief drove the widow over the edge? I mean, it happens, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely the basis for a good story. And I wonder if it was, you know, maybe a little therapeutic as well.
Oh, it had to be. It had to be.
You know, writing out thoughts and worries, putting them in a story where you have control of the ending, good or bad.
Very possible. And Marcia did write about the teacher who introduced Kiwi to journaling.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, and it helps Kiwi, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've never been much of a journaler. I mean, I want to. I buy beautiful books to journal in. I love getting journals as gifts, but mostly they just take up space on the shelf or in a drawer or...
Yeah. You know, I always start journaling and I have good intentions, but then it's like squirrels and I get sidetracked.
You get sidetracked?
I do. It's like total squirrels. That's what Josh says when he sees me doing something. He's squirrels.
Not shocked.
But I'm going to try to be better now that I have a grandson.
Well, you have a purpose now.
Right. I mean, I have... From my past, like so many unanswered questions from my grandparents, I need to stay committed. You got to help me.
I'll help you and so adorable little baby.
Mm.
And, you know, thought maybe our writing, journaling will come around in a different way. You never know, right?
Maybe.
But back to the spiderling.
Okay, tangent.
I wanted to talk about objective correlative.
Ooh, bringing the fancy school terms now, are we?
It only sounds fancy, but it's actually, you know, it's pretty basic, and it happens all the time in writing, particularly poetry, one of your favorites.
Oh, you're right, it does. Objective correlative was popularized by T.S. Eliot. Did you know that?
Yes, I knew that.
But it refers to actions, objects, or situations that correspond with and implicitly evoke a particular emotion from the reader or the audience. Thank you, Bedford.
Yes, I love Bedford.
Mm.
So, an object, action, or situation that serves a symbolic purpose. So, what it does is it, when this comes onto the paper, it brings about an image, gets an emotional response that implies a larger meaning than what is there.
Right.
So, I mean, basically, you're reading and you see this item or this action happens or this situation occurs and it causes an emotional reaction in you, the reader.
Oh, this happens all the time in literature.
All the time.
I mean, just think about like in our past stories, like the wheat penny in The Four Winds.
Right. Every time it appeared, you...
Right. Yeah. Bracelets, girls at play. Right?
Totally different feeling, but yes.
And then even the pregnancy and detransition baby.
Exactly. Now, in The Spiderling, we have an object that might not evoke emotion for all readers.
Oh, but how can it not?
Yeah, I agree with you. But there are also, you know, just think about it. There might be other actions, objects, or situations in this book that do that for other readers and not necessarily for us.
Oh, good
you
point.
Know? Your schema plays
right.
into it, right?
That's right. I mean, that's what I just love about literature. So many different things to so many different people. Okay, so let's talk about dog tags.
Yep.
As this is kind of what I remembered grabbed us, right?
Yep.
Is this where we're going with this?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm going to give just a quick little history on dog tags. So
oh, good.
Some form of a dog tag has been around since the Spartan army of the Roman Empire.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So those soldiers tied strings with their names to their wrists, which doesn't seem as durable as what we've got going on now. The dog tag is for identification of the soldier, obviously, mm-hmm. but it is their identity. In the past, if the soldier was killed in action, one tag was left with the body for identification purposes, and the other was sent back to the unit for accountability purposes. Now, if I can just tangent one other second little time,
okay.
There used to be this like horrible rumor that the dog tag was put in the mouth and the mouth was clamped shut to stay in there. Yeah, it's fake. Well, I even heard that when I was in the military. I heard that that's what, it's just a rumor.
Well,
it's
and also they have taken off social security numbers now.
Yes, they have.
Off dog tags.
Yeah, they do the soldier's military ID number.
Yeah, for
safety. And now, you know, instead of separating the two tags, so one for the unit and one for the soldier, they're just left on the body. And in the future, they're actually going to have chips in them.
Really?
Yeah, dog tags will have chips. So something you can just, which, you know, that's, you could put a lot of information on there and help them even more.
Oh, absolutely. Or maybe even locate them.
Right, exactly.
Right. But, you know, like dog tags for a soldier or for a spouse or for a child, those can evoke powerful and different emotions for mm-hmm. each individual. I mean, the first time we see Libby's soldier husband Deacon's dog tags, they are finally being returned after 3 years.
Right. Well, think of how he died.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, right.
And they are likened to a skeleton.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
It was so fitting. I mean, they are Deacon's skeleton, right?
Right.
And just like Libby, it made my breath catch.
I wonder if they removed the blood from him. I mean, because obviously when...
I don't know. In some ways, I feel like they would, but in some ways, I feel like the military is like, oh, we found this here. Just get it back to the family. They got other things they're worried about.
I would think that they'd probably clean the blood off.
Kiwi even thought about that, remember?
Yeah, she did. She did. I mean, I had so many emotions at that point. Pain. I mean, thinking of, you know, like other families that have received dog tags, you know, instead of their actual loved one, their person. I mean, they were relieved in having the item, you know, the dog tag. Mm-hmm. But it's just so heartbreaking not having your person, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Kiwi snatches those dog tags up as soon as she sees them. You know, they represented a piece of Deacon, but are also a reminder of what she no longer has, her father.
And I definitely felt all those things as well. It was very emotional,
It was.
And when Kiwi slipped them over her head and pressed them to her body, you could visualize that, couldn't you? I felt thankful she had them because it was something of her dad. And her mom, you know, she shared so little of him with her.
Oh, I cried in that section of the book. Oh, it was just awful.
Yeah.
But you know, those dog tags, they were very precious to her for sure. And to Libby.
Yeah.
You know.
They were.
But it's definitely different for Kiwi. I mean, there's pain, but there's also, you know, I felt there was comfort.
Oh, definitely. When Kiwi has to have the x-ray on her arm and the nurse wants to remove them, remember that? Ooh, she makes a fuss. She doesn't seem to have had anything of her father's, and these tags, you just know she can't bear to have them out of her sight.
Right.
You sense, you know, you feel her need to keep them on her.
Oh, you could. When Kiwi had the dog tags, I felt this feeling of, you know, protection maybe.
Mm.
Honestly, I guess I felt it throughout the entire book.
Mm.
But when she got her dad's tags, I mean, it felt stronger.
Yeah.
I mean, those tags are the last thing that touched his living body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the thing that is closest to his heart. Ugh.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, maybe for our listeners that don't have a military
connection. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was almost like those tags became a part of her, father protecting her. Oh, I don't want to cry now.
But that makes sense to me because Obviously we're the reader. We can't get into the book to actually protect her. Right. And you want to.
You do.
It was like someone in the story was finally there for her.
Right.
I know she had others along the way, but the dog tags, I don't know, they were a different kind of armor for her.
Now, do you remember when she ran away and they were trying to, you know, give a description of Kiwi to the police?
Yes.
I mean, her teacher,
mm-hmm.
insightful teacher,
mm-hmm.
tells them she had military dog tags around her neck. The fact that that teacher noticed that.
I know.
But, you know, like her father, those dog tags became a part of her identity.
That's right.
And oh, that teacher.
I know.
I wanted to hug up Mr. Mathis.
Because the poor, and Libby wanted to be able to describe her daughter, but the teacher was the one. But, you know, I wanted to give Libby the benefit of the doubt that she was so traumatized in that moment, but still.
But a good teacher, they pay attention to their students.
Yep, they sure do.
Yeah.
And those dog tags, they're like a small little detail, but it changes the police officer's actions as well.
Oh,
remember
it did.
That?
It really did.
Talks about him, and it just made me feel... I just felt this sense of pride because it was respect the officer was showing Libby. And then by extension, that respect was for Kiwi and her dad.
Oh, man. I mean, the military, the blue.
Yep.
Just with everything that's going on in society right now, you just, oh.
Yeah.
There were so many feels.
There were so many feels.
But then remember when she has them taken away from her in San Jose?
I know that was a little comical, but I also, that was a lot of emotions too, because Kiwi says they took her dignity. Remember that? But I felt that. Like, I definitely felt anger and indignation at that moment.
And then when Jeremiah helps her get them back. I mean, right. Come on, Jeremiah.
She thinks he's a miracle worker, does magic.
Right. And I was on that emotional roller coaster with her the entire book.
Yep. Thanks to objective correlative.
A fun little term all of our listeners can throw around at their next book talk. Yeah, thanks for reminding me of that fancy little term we learned in our English class.
Yep.
So let's move forward. Let's get on to our power theme. You know, that power theme we were kind of carrying throughout our season.
Yes.
Season's almost over.
I know, two more left.
This time we wanted to look at the power of grief and how it's connected to responsibility or the flip side of irresponsibility. Something that probably people aren't going to look at, you know, in a book club. I know it wasn't in those book club questions, but...
It wasn't. We had to come up with some new stuff, didn't we? Mm-hmm. So Libby and Kiwi, they are both experiencing the grief of the loss of this very important man in their lives,
definitely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
For Libby, it's the man she feels saved her. And for Kiwi, it's her father. He was her whole world.
For Libby, though, the power of her grief caused her to be irresponsible as a parent, right?
Yeah. Well, she was present physically.
She was. We'll give
her
that.
For the most part, right? Mm-hmm. But not emotionally.
No, she really wasn't. But we are also given a glimpse. Marcia's writing. Oh,
I know. I loved it.
We're just given that glimpse of her childhood. Mm. And, you know, Libby never really learned what a responsible parent looked like or even acted like, right?
No.
Kind of reminded me of The Push.
Yes, exactly.
Ashley Audrain's The Push. You know, kind of that matriarchal lineage that we saw there in that book.
Yeah, nice connection. And valid point on Libby. Her mother was a yeller, screamer, hitter.
Mm.
Libby doesn't, she doesn't want to become that to Kiwi. But she does find herself repeating the past.
And that causes her to retreat even more from Kiwi.
She doesn't want to hurt her.
Right when she really needs her.
Yes.
I mean, she just never learned what right looked like. Again, like in The Push.
Right. And, you know, they just needed some additional help, which the book touches on.
Right.
But to talk about Kiwi, she almost, I say almost, doesn't need her mother. Because the power of her grief has forced Kiwi to grow up. It's made her more responsible.
But we always need our mothers.
Well, yes.
Especially when we're 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree. Her mother, you know, not really being present, you know, forced her to be responsible way too early in life.
Mm-hmm.
But Kiwi did have people in her life that also taught her responsibility. She initially had her father. She even had those teachers.
She did. She had some great teachers.
Oh, she did. And it didn't seem like Libby ever had that.
No.
Mm-mm. Hadn't Libby's father, like, left the family when she was young? Did I read that?
Yeah, I think she was 10, and her father divorced her mother. I think it wasn't actually a divorce. I don't think he just ran out on them and left. But her childhood was really just memories of them drinking and fighting, her mother and father drinking and fighting.
Right. And Libby's father was not the pillar of responsibility. I do remember that. I mean, that was for sure.
Oh, yeah. Not even a little bit. But grief... You know, it's such a powerful thing, and it affects people in so many ways, and it really did affect Libby and Kiwi in these two very different ways.
You know, when I was thinking about this grief, responsibility, irresponsibility connection, I kept coming back to the title, The Spiderling.
Okay.
I see both Libby and Kiwi as a spiderling.
Like both of them?
Yes. I mean, I don't want to give a science lesson or go too far down the rabbit hole, but hear me out. I'm not going to be a Mr. Mathis.
I'm hearing, but I'll reel you in if it gets crazy.
Okay. So Kiwi is our obvious spiderling.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. The middle stages of her young life, as she should be. Not an egg and not yet an adult. Mm-hmm. She's in the stage in between. She's kind of being forced out of this stage earlier than she should be. But, you know, as we mentioned, she has had her father and teachers to help her have a foundation that Libby did not have. I mean, Kiwi is almost over mature for her age.
Well, she was kind of forced into that maturity, though.
True, but you could say the same about Libby, being forced into maturity, although it never really came to fruition, right?
Hmm. Yeah.
I think of her trauma of Deacon's death and the memory of such a crappy life growing up. I mean, it almost had this opposite effect on her. Maybe she even regressed.
Okay.
Or maybe just, maybe she was just stuck in the later spiderling stage.
Hmm.
It's a little hard for me to articulate without explaining, you know, the intricate stages of a spider. But we've got some really smart listeners who like to research a bit too.
We do.
We've received some of the emails.
Yeah.
But when Libby left home, I mean, how old was she?
I think she was 16. She was a teenager, yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she just went from loser guy to loser guy, right? Ugh,
she did. And I'm on your little track now because now I could just see her flying through the air from man to man on her spider silk.
Exactly. You get it. I envisioned that too. So thinking, you know, like these losers were going to take care of her, replace the father she didn't have until Deacon, right?
Yes.
I mean, and Deacon, generally, he was a good guy, and he did love her and take care of her like no one else had.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, since she, you know, was always being taken care of, she didn't learn how to take care of someone else, in a sense.
But I see your point, but I felt like she had to take care of herself when she was younger, though.
Oh, yes, I think she did. I mean, it was like survival mode.
Okay.
And Kiwi does that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see that in her journal entries.
Yeah.
However, the difference is that Kiwi also takes care of Libby.
Ah. And so that's, you know, that's the kind of the thing that pushes Kiwi out of that spiraling stage.
Exactly. And what kind of keeps Libby in hers.
Aha.
Until the end of the story, obviously.
Right.
I felt the ending took us out of a state of grief and into a, you know, a sense of little science term like homeostasis.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really, really powerful.
It was.
Feel free to revisit science class and look up, you know, a spider life cycle, friends.
Yeah.
I'm curious if anyone else sees a similar connection.
I am too. The power of grief, you know, that's really something, right?
Oh, right. I agree.
So think about what it can do. I think every day I feel so fortunate to have lived this long and not lost someone so, so impactful.
Other than grandparents, you know, a few aunts and uncles and a very few close friends. I mean, we're getting to that age. I mean, I've never really had to deal with that type of grief. I mean, it's hard to articulate if you've never walked through it, right?
Right.
Because we can never say we understand.
No, you can't.
No. I just feel that the story walks you through it so clearly and so concisely. I mean, it was like Marcia knew what it felt like.
Yeah.
I know she's lost her husband, you know, but maybe she was walking through her own grief cycle.
Right.
I don't know. But, you know, you feel a sense of peace after reading the last page. You just know at the end it's going to be okay.
I agree, though. She didn't leave you as an author in that place.
Right.
You are able to get this sense. The sense of relief,
yeah.
Right. The sense of relief and the sense of closure.
Right.
I know it feels, I'm going to change subject a little bit,
okay.
Right?
No, we need to. We need to move on.
I know it probably feels like we've said everything there possibly could be said about spiders, but just want to look at them from the symbology angle.
You know, I'm really happy to talk about spiders. I just don't want to be put in a room with a spider. Sorry.
Are you scared of spiders? Like, do you have a little arachnophobia or whatever the word is?
No, something, I guess. Don't tell me you're not afraid.
No, I'm not.
Really?
I think spiders are beyond fascinating, and I love watching them. You know, I have to tell you, while we were working on this, I had a little spider friend that was living, like, around my computer and on my keyboard. I saved him. I took him outside.
You would.
But I mean, I just love watching them. I think they're so fascinating. That's actually perfect for this because spiders inspire fear and fascination.
Have you ever seen a brown recluse spider bite?
Yes.
Then you know they can cause horrible gutting and a deep skin sore. Wendy, you can die.
True, but you can die from a lot of things. I think spiders rate pretty low.
Not putting myself in the path of spider death just to prove your point.
I think you're pretty safe. But back to our book. I think of Libby as the fear side, afraid of Kiwi, afraid of being a mom, afraid of life in general, whereas Kiwi is pure fascination, love school, learning new words, even the traffic game she plays, remember that?
Mm.
And running away to confess to a murder.
Oh boy, that game. I tell you what, closing your eyes and trying to cross the street. I mean, what was she thinking?
Maybe she saw a spider.
Ugh.
No, she's fascinated with the challenge of doing it. Will this be the time a car hits her? For another connection, do you know spiders live everywhere except Antarctica?
Of course they do, those creepy little bugs. But so do our military families, which are not creepy little bugs.
So you see the relationship.
Oh, I do. I had to think about that. I do. Of course I do.
Right?
Yes.
Perfect.
Perfecto.
Now, spiders, they also represent patience, communication, creativity, wisdom.
Okay. Communication is the one thing these two don't really have. But they're working on it, right?
They are. Now, a spider is actually a positive. It's a good thing.
Mm.
Think about resilience, right? We love that word, don't we?
We do, especially being in the military.
Think of all those webs you are walking through on your way to the gym.
Oh, I'd rather not, thank you.
But they just keep building them back. They're resilient.
Well, I do see your point in relation to this story. Perhaps spiders should find an area where they can take a break from web-building resiliency, and I can walk in peace.
You'll have to take that up with your spider friends.
Ugh.
But as for this story, a fitting little symbol.
I do have to agree with you there. Kiwi is also quite fitting. Her name, that is.
Well, we know she's named after the fruit, but she also learns there is a bird with the same name. And of course, she has to go research it.
I love that about her too, didn't no, you?
She's just like us.
Felt at home. But kiwi, the kiwi bird, it's an odd sort of bird.
Mm-hmm.
A bit like kiwi herself, right?
Yep.
Something she's almost quite proud of, I felt.
Oh yeah, I got that feeling.
And then when she watched the video at the library of the kiwi that it just wanted to fly.
No.
I'll put that video's the website in our show notes because you guys have got to watch it. You're going to get to the end and like me, you're going to cry.
It was so sad.
But it was also so perfectly our kiwi, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And just a quick reminder for everyone, since it's just briefly mentioned in the book, but a kiwi, you know, a kiwi bird wants to fly. So he anchors all these trees to the side of a cliff and then jumps off so he can get the feeling of flying.
Right. And Kiwi, she watched it over and over. And what stuck out to her was that he gave up his whole life to just once know the thrill of flying.
Oh, that made me think of Kiwi's game. You know, when she felt down, I mean, like the little kiwi bird did. So she went out and played the traffic game. I mean, I think she liked the thrill of adrenaline. And there are, you know, there's lots of visions of life and death in the novel, throughout the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just kind of, the situation with the kiwi bird, it just kind of felt like a metaphor.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, Kiwi is willing to give up everything. She's willing to give it all up, go to prison.
All right.
To get her mother's love, to see her father in heaven. Those are two thrills she's willing to do anything for.
Exactly. And you know how my mind works.
Sometimes I try. Do you want to touch on Moxie real quick?
Oh, sure, real quick. Moxie was her stuffed animal.
Yep.
A gift from her father.
Right.
So Moxie means courage, determination, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is Kiwi.
Right.
So asking Miss Marsha how she came to this name, she said Moxie embodies the grit and determination Kiwi was going to need, and also the daring to do what she needed to do.
I mean, Kiwi had Moxie in spades, right?
All right.
Maybe even a little too much, as she took quite a few risks.
Maybe, but it does symbolize our intrepid little hero.
For sure. Speaking of heroes, let's talk about the unspoken in this book, the Gold Star family.
Oh, yeah. People have probably heard the term, you know, before and have an idea of what it is. But, you know, I thought maybe sharing the history of it might be of some interest.
Mm-hmm.
Libby and Kiwi are a Gold Star family. They are the immediate family of a fallen service member who died while serving in a time of conflict.
Right. A spouse, partner, father, mother, brother, sister.
Right.
It's immediate family.
Right. This term was first used in World War I. I found that really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Families of service members would display flags with blue stars, one star for each service member deployed. If a service member died in combat, the family would replace that blue star with a gold star.
And it wasn't unusual to see flags with multiple blue stars or even flags with blue and Gold Stars.
No, it wasn't. I mean, my grandfather was, unfortunately, part of a Gold Star family.
Really?
Yeah. His brother, which would have been my great uncle, right? Mm-hmm. His name was Second Lieutenant George Alquist. He was killed in France.
Really?
Yes. They buried him at the Meuse-Argonne. I swear that's the name of it. Meuse-Argonne American Cemetery there in France.
Really?
Yeah. Now, my great-grandmother, which would have been his mother, mm-hmm. Was able to take a ship and visit, you know, his grave with other Gold Star mothers.
Oh, that's right? Wonderful.
I know. And then a couple summers ago, you know, my son, his wife, Josh, and I were able to visit the grave in France. Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, that's got to be such a special memory.
Mm-hmm. It was.
When Rufino and I were living in Germany, we visited Ardennes in Belgium.
Mm.
Don't you think it's kind of hard to explain the effect of seeing and being in a place like that?
Oh, it is. I mean, for anyone who's been to Arlington National Cemetery, they're very similar.
Yes.
I mean, you have the small white stone markers in just perfect rows.
Perfect.
With carefully trimmed grass. And just, it's quiet. It's just the hush.
Right.
Hush silence.
Mm. I mean, it's the one thing America requested of European countries was a place to bury their dead.
Right. Now, there are several types of organizations that support Gold Star families. And if you are interested in volunteering or supporting in some way, check out their website, American Gold Star Families. I'll link it in our show notes.
Okay.
Pretty easy to find. You just have to Google it.
Yeah. Great idea. Well, Amy, do you have anything else you want to add?
Well, if any of you listening are looking for a book club book for your own book club, I highly recommend The Spiderling.
Agree.
Marsha Preston has included 12 really great, mm-hmm. and I'm really great, thought-provoking questions in the back. Not your typical book club question, so you could definitely tell she was an English teacher.
Right, but not hard questions.
Oh, no,
don't worry about that.
No.
They are fun discussion questions. You won't be back in English class.
Not at all. So, what did you think about Enza Prosecco?
It's not too bad. I noticed there's kind of like a bite at the end.
Yeah.
I'm still getting the honey. Makes my mouth feel sticky and sweet, just like I predicted.
Oh, I agree. This is the type of bubbly that, you know, gives you a hangover.
Yeah. Well, if you have like 5 bottles of it, but yeah.
Yeah. It's the kind of bubbly I'd serve to an ex-husband's sister's daughter at her elopement in Las Vegas.
Something I don't know?
I mean, you can see my recent trip there is kind of infiltrating my tasting notes.
I'm not even going to try.
And I don't even have an ex-husband.
Not yet.
No.
And you won't die.
And he doesn't have a sister either. I just kind of made that up.
I figured. But, I mean, I wasn't even going to try to follow that. But if you were serving this, what would you serve with it at this elopement?
Jeez. I mean, I provided the Prosecco. Now I have to bring snacks? Are you kidding me?
I just think the hostess with the mostess wouldn't miss on a perfect pairing.
We are talking about an ex-husband. So I think Prosecco is more than generous. But since you asked, I think I would like to pair it like with a creamy Chimay.
Ooh.
I mean, Chimay, it just kind of smells like your boyfriend's toe jam after football practice.
Mm.
But it tastes like a creamy slice of deliciousness in your mouth.
It sounds sophisticated.
Mm.
The way you put it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to agree, Chimay cheese would be a great pair with this.
I told you I wouldn't exude sophistication and elegance. I mean, you think one little bottle of crappy Prosecco is going to change that?
One can only hope. But I actually agree with your description of Chimay, and that would be a great pairing. I'm also thinking of truffle cheese.
Oh, yeah. Love truffle cheese. Truffle cheese, truffle sauce, a drizzle of truffle oil.
So truffles?
Yes, duh.
Love truffle cheese.
Me too.
Totally agree. Do you have a rating for this one?
Unfortunately, I think I can only give this Prosecco a 3.5. It's a little bit higher than some of our previous ones.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It's a little too sweet for my liking.
I agree. 3.5, too sweet. I told you that honey taste usually means it'll be too sweet for us.
You did. It's not the worst, but it's not the best.
Well, we don't have any leftovers this time, so that says something.
Ooh, that's a first in a while.
Right?
Like, we finished the bottle.
Like about 5 episodes. Wow. Right.
But go ahead and let everyone know what's coming up next episode before we tangent to some other nonsense.
I think I better. We have a truly fantastic short story.
Oh, we do.
Oh, it's so good.
Can't wait.
I know. The Hands of Dirty Children by a new author, Alejandro Puyana, paired with Ogio. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks again for joining us for an episode of Prosecco in Prose. To view the complete show notes for today's episode, visit www.proseccoinprose.com and follow the link to Buzzsprout.
Please follow or subscribe.
It's free wherever you listen, and you'll be the first to know when new episodes drop.
You can even show your support by rating and leaving us a review,
which helps other lit lovers discover our show.
Feel free to connect with us on our website or any of our social media.
Or you can find us on Clubhouse.
I'm Wendy.
And I'm Amy, signing off as our bottle of bubbly is now empty.
See you for the next episode. And in the meantime,
pop a cork and read.